Yeah. For the second of our Apollo 15 science results briefings, first quick look at the data. Lunar orbital experimenters and managers, and I will turn it over to George F. Essenwine, Jr., who is the Lunar Orbital Experiments Program Manager in the Apollo office in NASA headquarters, and he will introduce his colleagues.
Good afternoon. Welcome, captive audience, to the world of orbital science. Looks a little wet out there. Apollo 15 is achieving many firsts, and not the least among those is orbital science, and that's the remote sensing of the lunar surface from the command and service module while it's in orbit. I think uniquely, we're gathering backside data for the first time, at least of a geochemical nature, that we have not gathered before, nor have any of the other orbital type programs. In addition to that, we're gathering very accurate photography of the lunar backside for the first time. The orbital science operations are still underway, as you know. To date, we're getting excellent results of both the scientific data as well as the operational aspects, which I'll mention a little later. We have three major events left to go. One is this afternoon, the jettison of the sub-satellite, placing it in lunar orbit. Al Warden's EVA tomorrow morning to retrieve the films from the scientific instrument module, and during the translunar coast, the gathering of galactic data. The operation of the orbital science is very much an integral part of the CSM operation. We have to live together. It's not like the ALSEP that's left on the surface to operate by itself. As a result of that, it takes a lot of planning before you undertake a mission such as Apollo 15. We were very fortunate in starting out with a very superbly planned flight plan that really maximized the orbital science data return. Every nook and cranny of that flight plan was taken advantage of to get another photo or a couple of more minutes of data of some type. In addition to the starting out with a very fine plan, the real-time operational people have done a very fine job in executing this. They've given all the consideration they could to orbital science anytime a real-time decision was needed. And there was trade-off between the spacecraft operations and the gathering of the science data. In addition, as you see here, representatives of the orbital science team, these people or their members have worked 24 hours a day around the clock with the operationals group to be there to help in making science priority decisions as well as recommendations on the operation of the various experiments. The CMP, Al Warden, has been carrying out this very complicated and busy flight schedule, right on schedule and right on the cues. Overall, we're very pleased with the operation and the support of orbital science and the data as we see it coming back to date. Not all has been 100% rosy, however, as you know. We've had some disappointments with two of our experiments. However, overall, this is not debilitating to the reduction of the data, and we'll hear a little bit more about that from the scientist as we go down the line. The preliminary science results we received to date are very exciting, and I think they hold a promise that the Apollo 15 orbital science program will have been a very complete success. With that, we'll start down the line here, and you'll hear a little bit more detail about each one of the experiments and then a brief summary by Al Mazursky. With that, I'd like to introduce Dr. James Arnold, who is the principal investigator for the gamma ray spectrometer. Jim?
Thank you, George. I don't know how much to focus on the science or how much on the operations. I consider myself although I come from the University of California, kind of a veteran here at Houston because I've been so deeply involved in the lunar sample program, but this is the first time I've ever sat with the earphones on in the operational loop, and I'm fascinated by that. The gamma ray experiment was one of a group of three surface geochemical sensors. Other two gentlemen sitting next to me, X-ray and the alpha, which have been, these experiments have been proposed for many years as a way of making a chemical map, compositional map, of the surface of the moon to tell us something which the lunar surface missions can't possibly tell us. In a lunar surface mission, we go down and bring back material, suites of samples, get voluminous information on each one. But each one is only a point, even if it's as fascinating a point as the Hadley-Apennines area. What geochemists always have wanted to do is to get typical or average compositions for essentially different regions, whether it's in the Earth or the Moon. On the Earth, we have to analyze thousands of rocks, perhaps, to find out what a certain province of North America is like. By averaging in this way, by flying an instrument that looks from horizon to horizon or over many degrees, we can get these averages as such, directly. And as George says, we can get back side information where such information is hardly likely to become available very soon from anybody's manned or unmanned missions. So that's what's going on. Our particular experiment responds to gamma rays coming from the lunar surface either directly as radioactive decay of potassium, uranium, and thorium, which are the radioactive elements that are most important on Earth or Moon. And because cosmic rays are bombarding the lunar surface, we can see certain other elements as well. I think perhaps what you're most interested in is how far we've gotten and what kind of scientific conclusions we can draw. Talk about the hardware, it's worked well. We are a little handicapped here as the mission flight controllers have learned to hear us say not once but 100 times, we are data limited, statistics limited. We have to put everything we've got together, but we've got a lot now, and we can begin to talk about the general run of our data, and that's all that I can possibly say today. But summarize it in the following way. We've seen on Apollo 11 and 12 and 14 variations in the content of radioactive elements on the surface of the moon. These radioactive elements are especially important because they have a great deal to do with the heat history of the moon. They generate the heat on the lunar interior. Apollo 14 was very different from the two Mare sites, Apollo 11 and 12. The radioactive elements, especially the uranium and thorium, were very high as the granites in the crustal rocks of the Earth's continents, although the detailed composition was very different. We did not know before now whether this was typical of the highlands, because this is a possible Framaro, a sort of highland site, or whether it was a remarkable and unique thing. Our present opinion, based on a pretty good look at the backside, which is almost entirely highland, and on an analysis of some frontside passes as well, is that that's not true. Our present opinion is that the radioactivity of the surface layers of the moon is not typically so high as the radioactivity of the Apollo 14 site. We have seen hot spots. We were a little embarrassed by a rumor that was picked up and sent up to the astronauts, giving it an area of gospel truth, something that I saw on a monitor for 5 minutes. I cannot verify particular places for those hot spots, but there certainly are some places on the moon which are much more radioactive. But the run of things is indicating that at least where the radioactive elements are concerned, there's a less high degree of differentiation than perhaps might have been expected. That's as far as we can go right now. We think our data are in very good shape. We think once we get the prime data in a few weeks on the tapes, we'll be able to go to work with them and get a lot more detailed information.
Okay, thank you, Jim. Next principal investigator is Dr. Adler from Goddard, who is the principal investigator for the X-ray spectrometer. Is he? All right. I gave you the first one, Dr. James Arnold. This is Dr. Isidore Adler from the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center.
Well, as Dr. Arnold has indicated, there are three component experiments in this geochemical package, and ours is the X-ray experiment. And Dr. Gorenstein, sitting on my left, will talk about the alpha particle experiment. I guess of the three experiments, we're most fortunate in the sense that we can see such substantial fluxes that we can begin to make more rapid evaluations. Our statistics are very good. The sun has been very, very obliging, and I mention this because our X-rays are produced as a result of solar X-rays. And at least for a brief period of time, when we examined the data yesterday, the sun seemed remarkably stable. So much so, in fact, this was more than we could have hoped for. The consequence of this is that as one flies around and around, because the sun has been behaving in such a stable fashion, one can actually get sort of redundant spectra for the same areas on the moon. Just to say a little bit about the experiment, we're looking at X-rays which are produced on the lunar surface as a result of excitation by the solar X-rays. And from our point of view, these are very, very important secondary X-rays because they're characteristic of some of the elements in the lunar surface. Unfortunately, there are a limited number of elements we can see, and this is strictly because of the exciting flux of the sun. It'll only excite such elements as silicon, aluminum, magnesium. What is very, very nice is that these are important elements and are important signature elements. Well, not only is the sun behaving nicely, but our experiment is behaving very well, too. We've been getting at least more X-ray counts in given intervals than I had could possibly have hoped for, which is very, very nice. And we've taken a quick cut at reducing some of the data. What we've done is normalized on silicon, because this is fairly constant in the moon, and we've tried to determine what the ratio of aluminum to silicon is as we fly around the moon. And I invite you later, if you like, to come up and take a look at the map which we've put up there on our left, which shows two traverses. These are ground tracks across the moon on which I plotted these ratios. And the one ground track is a particularly interesting one because it has covered a large part of the backside. And I think we can now say with some assurance that, in fact, the highlands are richer in aluminum than the Mare areas. This shows up consistently. In fact, if you look at the data there, you will find that as one goes from the highlands into the Mare areas, there's a distinct drop in silicon aluminum, and it promptly rises again as one climbs out of the Mare area and goes to the highlands. And talking to some of the geochemists with whom we're working, they find this to be a particularly significant result. I think Dr. Guest said something about that this morning. It does indicate that perhaps the highlands are very like the composition which had been predicted. So overall, we're extremely gratified, and so I can say that I guess we're going to be going home with reams and reams of data and then something best described as a mood of euphoria. Thank you.
Thank you, Izzy. Not only is Izzy's experiment working very nicely, but he has the fastest computer system around here. I think he even has part of his family here with a slide rule working, helping him out. The next experiment is the alpha spectrometer. Dr. Paul Gorenstein from American Science and Engineering is the principal investigator for this experiment. Paul?
Yes. The purpose of the alpha particle experiment, the third component of the geochemistry package, was to look for a radon emanation from the moon. We know from the Apollo 11, 12, and particularly the 14 samples that uranium and thorium are found in appreciable quantities on the moon, or at least at those landing sites. And the significance of this to the alpha survey is that uranium and thorium eventually decay into radon gas. Radon gas, under certain conditions, can migrate to the surface of the moon, where it can remain trapped by the lunar gravity long enough for the subsequent nuclear decay of radon gas to produce alpha particles. These alpha particles are, because they're of uniform energies, in contrast to the background of various nuclear effects that occur at the surface of the moon, are easily detectable in principle by special detectors which look for these particular characteristic energies. We look particularly for areas in the moon that might be characterized by increased radon emanation and try to locate kinds or possibly hotspots. The regions of the moon in which we might see increased radon emanation would be quite possibly a region which there would be escaping volatiles in general, escaping normal volatiles such as water or carbon dioxide. If there are such components escaping, reaching the surface, it is quite likely, given the rather appreciable uranium and thorium concentrations, that radon will be evolved along with these normal volatiles. This kind of process does indeed occur in the Earth, and a map of the radon evolution of the Earth is really quite indicative of interesting geological or perhaps geophysical features, particularly increased volatile emission. Our hope was that given this capability of detecting a monoenergetic alpha particle from the decay of radon, we might be able to locate and pinpoint such possible interesting areas on the moon. The experiment was considered to be quite speculative in a certain sense, in that according to certain viewpoints, the processes which promote the radon emanation on the Earth would not be present on the moon, so that even with the concentrations that we believe to exist grossly on the moon as deduced from return samples, we might not see such an effect. However, if we did see anything at all in the evolution of radon, it would be extremely interesting because it would really be, in a true sense, a rather new lunar phenomenon and a rather new kind of input that that lunar specialists would have. As we've been looking at the data, our first conclusion is that the instrument has been performing quite well. The quality of the data has been good. The instrument seems the internal stands of the instrument indicate that it's performed well. And what conclusions I might make concerning the data, I think I'll just have to temper with the kind of remark that that every one of my colleagues on here would also make, and that the quantity of data, or in particular the quick look data that we're viewing at our consoles, really represents only a fraction of what we're ultimately going to see, so that the ultimate power or capability to experiment at this stage of the analysis is really considerably less than what ultimately would be. So at least I'm personally somewhat hesitant at trying to quote any major conclusions at this point. I think Dr. Abbott is a bit lucky considering his enormous fluxes. I think we can say at this point that the net lunar radon emanation is somewhere between a factor of 100 or 1,000 less than the terrestrial values, in spite of the fact that the lunar concentrations of uranium, thorium, perhaps only a factor of 10 smaller than the terrestrial values. Hence, we can conclude that certainly in general, the major mechanism which promotes the radon evolution on the Earth is certainly not operating on the moon. But I, again, would like to emphasize that our ability to study the effect at this moment is limited. We are seeing only a subset of our data, and we expect that with the refinements in the analysis that will ultimately occur as we see the greater part of the data, or as we're allowed to massage it in the appropriate way, will give us ultimately significantly more sensitivity, and so that it's quite possible that these extremely interesting effects will show up. That concludes what I'd like to say at this moment about the alpha particle spectrometer and the lunar geochemistry, and I just would like to make a few remarks about some further experimental work that's being planned for the lunar X-ray fluorescence spectrometer, the same instrument that Dr. Adler has been working with right now in the analysis of lunar data. there is a series of galactic X-ray astronomy observations planned for this instrument during the trans-Earth coast phase of the Apollo 15 mission, in which the astronauts will point the X-ray spectrometer at certain preselected locations and into deep space. The objective of these observations will be to study the temporal characteristics or time variability of certain pulsating X-ray sources. These are a rather interesting and rather new phenomenon of rapidly varying X-ray sources that were discovered by the X-ray satellite Uhuru over the past few months. And the Apollo instrument represents a rather unique capability compared to all X-ray astronomy instruments operating at the present time, in that it can hold a pointing position for sustained periods of time for about an hour, perhaps more, and allow us to study the time variability of these pulsations, look for periodicities up to a time scale of an hour if they're indeed present, in a rather unprecedented manner. Two of the objects that have been selected for study during the Apollo 15 mission correspond to objects which can be seen also on Earth-based radio telescopes, and one object can also be seen in an optical telescope. So we have tried as much as possible to enlist the aid of ground-based observers to do simultaneous coordinated observations with their instruments in conjunction with the Apollo 15 spectrometer. And ultimately, by combining these results, we feel we can bring some significant new inputs into these special studies of galactic X-ray sources. It's interesting to note that the ground-based optical observatory, which will be participating in the coordinated study of SCO-X1, will be in the Soviet Union. It turns out that the time favorable for the observations from the Apollo was rather unfavorable from the point of view of optical observatories in the Western Hemisphere or in West Europe. This left the only major observatory that can participate in this coordinated observation to be the Crimean Astrophysical Observatory in the Soviet Union, and we're gratified that they're interested in participating. And so this experiment may mark the first occasion which there will be a direct collaboration or participation of between NASA and a Soviet group directly during the Apollo mission. We feel that these galactic X-ray astronomy observations will also be quite significant and can be accomplished using the same hardware that has proven so successful in the lunar X-ray fluorescence observation on the moon's surface.
Okay. Thank you, Paul. The orbital science is a comprehensive program covering many disciplines, as you heard from Paul, and not only in the galactic, the lunar surface, but also in the lunar atmosphere itself. And Dr. John Hoffman from the University of Texas is a principal investigator for the mass spectrometer.
Thank you, George. As such, our instrument is not part of the geochemical experiments that you have just heard about, but it is a spectrometer and is classed amongst the spectrometers that were flown on this mission. It is a mass spectrometer, but its data, while it will be primarily looking for gases in the lunar atmosphere, this data will be associated with that from the other three geochemical experiments, and so we will be doing some correlations there. I think perhaps the most common description of the lunar atmosphere is that there isn't any. However, the purpose of this experiment was to go up to the moon with a mass spectrometer and determine, first of all, whether an atmosphere exists. If it does, what does it consist of? What gases are in the lunar atmosphere? And how do they vary with time and location around the moon? The instrument, as I said, was a mass spectrometer. It measures the type and the quantity of each gas in a mixture of gases that are presented to the instrument, in this case, the lunar atmosphere. The instrument is mounted on a boom, which extends out from the service module of the spacecraft 24 feet. This allows the instrument to be removed from the immediate vicinity of the spacecraft itself. Now, the instrument operates on the end of its boom. Perhaps you might envision it as a bird with a mouth open who's flying along, and the gas molecules that it's trying to measure are like bugs sitting in the atmosphere. So the instrument's flying along like a bird, gobbling up these bugs, and then telling us what kind they are and how many are there. It has operated very well. We have collected 46 hours, roughly, of prime data, that is, with the instrument in the direction such that the mouth of it is in the direction that we're moving, gobbling up the molecules or the bugs. But in addition to that, we need to fly the instrument backwards, as though the bird were flying now with its tail pointing forward and running away from the bugs. In other words, it's moving away and none of these molecules can get into it. We call this background data, and this was obtained for about 7 hours throughout the mission. We have to actually take the differences between the background data and the data in the prime direction in order to determine our results. Previous measurements of the lunar atmosphere have been obtained from Apollo 14 and also now from 15 from the cold cathode gauge experiment, which is part of the ALSEP package, which I believe you've already heard about. This experiment has, on Apollo 14, has shown that there actually is a lunar atmosphere, and also has shown at least one or more events that have been interpreted as gas being released from the lunar atmosphere at some distance from the location of the instrument and then traveling across the surface to the instrument. I think that as far as the results of this particular experiment, it's difficult to say anything positive, as my colleagues have already expressed, based upon the quick look type of data that we've obtained off of our consoles, as we have only seen a very small fraction of the total data that will be presented to us when all the magnetic tapes are collected and so forth. We can say, though, that the instrument has operated well, has given us many, many spectra, that is, analyses of the lunar atmosphere. It takes about 1 minute to make an analysis of what gases are in the atmosphere, and so we get over 100 such analyses as the spacecraft makes one orbit around the moon. It will require a statistical analysis of the data to determine what the nature of the actual lunar atmosphere is. We plan and hope that it'll show from that whether or not such gases as neon and argon, which are actually expected in the lunar atmosphere, do exist and how much. I think what I can say so far is that the lunar atmosphere is indeed very rarefied, at least as much so as was expected from theoretical considerations. I believe also that our prime data is going to come from the dark side of the moon, where the temperatures are much lower than on the sunlit side of the moon. We have observed in looking at the very sketchy data that we have already what appears to be an event of gas being released from the moon. And this would be analogous to what the cold cathode gauge perhaps had seen on Apollo 14. This event occurred on the backside shortly after sunset. And the principal gas associated with this event was carbon dioxide. The data, of course, are going to be searched for many more such events. We hope to be able to find them. But it's very exciting to have seen this particular event, which occurred very suddenly on the dark side of the moon. We're very pleased with the way the instrument worked and the amount of data we've gotten and the success of the Apollo 15 mission, which allowed us to obtain this exciting data on the lunar atmosphere.
Thank you, John. John had another exciting time during the mission. His experiment was a little slow in retracting, and it must be retracted prior to a major maneuver of the command and service module, such as the SPS firing. So he had to make the decision if he wanted to stay in lunar orbit for an unlimited time without data or retract and wait till he got around on the light side where it was a little warmer, and he waited. All right, the next speaker is Dr. Fred Doyle of the U.S. Geological Survey, who is chairman of the Apollo photographic team and will discuss the operation of the camera and the laser altimeter.
The largest single component instrument in the service module bay is a panoramic camera. Panoramic camera has a focal length of 24 inches, and it records a frame of pictures which is 4.5 inches wide by 47.5 inches long. The camera has enough film for a total of 1,700 such frames. It may be interesting to note that each one of those frames contains 15 times 10 to the 9 bits of information. That's 15 trillion bits of information on each frame of that photography. So the camera really represents the most comprehensive data-gathering instrument that NASA has ever flown. The objectives for the panoramic camera were, first of all, to photograph the landing site pre and post each of the EVAs. There are also a number of selected areas which may be considered as landing sites for Apollo 17. These were our second priority for coverage. Third priority was the LEM impact point after jettison after rendezvous. Our fourth objective was to photograph the near terminator areas where the solar altitude is low and we get strong shadows and high definition on the lunar surface. And the final objective is to provide general coverage of the entire lunar surface overflown by the spacecraft in daylight. The panoramic camera contains one component which is referred to as the velocity over height sensor. This sensor essentially measures the rate of passage of the lunar scene underneath the camera. And the output of that sensor is used to control the cycling rate of the camera, the overlap between successive frames, and the width of the exposure slit, which controls the exposure of the photography. The V over H sensor is supposed to operate in the nominal range from 40 to 80 nautical miles altitude. If at any time the output shows that it has exceeded that rate, it automatically resets itself to 60 nautical miles, which is the nominal altitude for most of the mission. On Rev 4, which was the first photographic pass, we noticed that the V over H sensor was consistently off scale and resetting to the nominal 60 nautical mile altitude. We did not consider this too serious on Rev 4 since that was a highly elliptical orbit pass. The next photographic pass was on Rev 15 and 16, and there we confirmed that the V over H sensor was indeed oscillating between off scale and the 60 nautical mile nominal setting. This condition has continued throughout the mission, and it results in a certain amount of our data being degraded. Our estimate is that about 40% of the photography will achieve the high resolution, 2 to 3 meters, which we had anticipated. Another 40% of the photography will be degraded somewhat so that the resolution will be between 3 and 10 meters. And about 20% of the data will be seriously degraded so that the resolution will be less than 10 meters on those frames. We have checked the telemetry data after each of the panoramic camera photographic passes and correlated this with the time and the spacecraft position. And we are confident that we have achieved good photography over each of the critical sites, that is, over the landing site, after each of the EVAs, the possible Apollo 17 sites, and the LEM impact point. The second component of the photographic systems in the service module is the mapping camera. The mapping camera objective is to obtain cartographic quality photography over the entire area overflown by the spacecraft in daylight. Combined with the mapping camera is a stellar camera which photographs the star field in synchronism with each frame exposed of the surface, and the laser altimeter which records an elevation reading or an altitude reading from the spacecraft to the ground at the time each of the mapping camera frames is exposed. The mapping camera has operated nominally throughout the mission. We have some slight indication that some of the frames may be overexposed, but only very lightly. On Rev 38, the altimeter quit. Consequently, all of the subsequent dark side passes with the mapping camera were deleted. On Rev 50, we turned off the mapping camera during the pan camera operation over the landing site against the possible correlation of the failure of the V over H sensor with the mapping camera operation. However, this had no effect on the V over H sensor. It did cause us to lose a very slight bit of lunar surface coverage. Because of the delay in the jettison of the LEM on the Rev 58 pass was deleted and moved back to Rev 60. This again caused us a decrease in the side lap between adjacent flight passes, and this will have some effect on the data reduction, but not too seriously. The failure of the altimeter will result in a decrease in the accuracy of the control point network, which we hope to establish with the mapping camera photography. We had anticipated that if we had successful mapping photography, successful stellar photography, and successful altimetry, we would be able to establish the position of any point seen by the cameras with an accuracy of about plus or minus 15 meters. We expect that the loss of the altimeter will degrade that to about 30 meters in the areas where the altimeter did not operate. However, all of the major objectives for the mapping camera have been met. The third instrument is the laser altimeter. The laser altimeter is supposed, first of all, to provide a measured altitude in synchronism with each of the mapping camera frames. It is also supposed to operate independently on the dark side in order to correlate the topographic profiles with the gravity anomalies, and Mr. Shogren will describe to you some of the results that we did obtain. The operation of the altimeter was nominal through Rev 24. That is to say, we apparently received very good data that far down in the mission. On Rev 27, we noticed that some of the altitude words were in obvious error. On Rev 34 and 35, this condition became progressively worse, and it seemed to be correlated with a rise in the temperature of the laser altimeter cavity. Consequently, on Rev 36 and 37, we extended the altimeter but did not operate it during the dark side pass. This did result in a cooling down of the cavity temperature. However, when we came around and received telemetry on Rev 38, it was apparent that the altimeter had failed completely. As a consequence of that, we deleted all of the subsequent dark side passes, but we did operate the altimeter with the mapping camera passes on the light side. We obtained an occasional word that seemed to be valid, an occasional altitude measurement that seemed to be valid. However, these will have an inconsequential effect on the data analysis. On Rev 63, we made an attempt to revive the altimeter by a switching procedure that was sent up to Al Warden and required him to flip the switches a number of times in the command module. However, this was unsuccessful, and the altimeter has remained dormant so far as we can tell. We have obtained so far only about a little less than a half of the altimeter data that we had expected to obtain. As I have mentioned, this will degrade the accuracy of the control network established with the mapping camera. It will limit the correlation of the topography with gravity on the dark side to those areas where the altimeter did operate successfully. On the light side, we will be able to get the topography by eventual reduction of the mapping camera photographs so that we will meet that objective on the light side passes. We have essentially completed the photographic objectives for this mission. The pan camera, as you may have heard just as you came into the room, has expended the last of its film. We do have considerable film left in the mapping camera due to the fact that we deleted the dark side passes. We will take some photographs of the whole moon after trans-Earth injection, and we will take some additional photographs of the star field during the trans-Earth coast, simply in order to have some extra film to play with before we process it. We do have one critical operation which yet remains to be performed. Tomorrow morning, Al Warden must go from the command module back to the service module and recover the film magazines. If that fails, everything fails. However, we are confident that that will go as well as all of the other astronaut activities during this mission. We will not know for sure how good our results are until the actual film is returned here to Houston in about a week and is processed. At that time, we will be able to examine all of the photographs to tell exactly what areas were covered successfully and what areas failed. However, we are confident that we have obtained more useful photography of the lunar surface during this mission than has been obtained in all of the lunar missions, manned and unmanned, up until this time. Thank you, George.
Thank you, Fred. This is the first flight, of course, for this orbital science package, and I see we have a few bugs to work out. I do feel confident that for Apollo 16, we will have diagnosed these problems and have them corrected for the next flight. The next investigator is Mr. Bill Shogren from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, who is responsible for the S-band transponder experiment, that dealing with the lunar gravity. Bill?
Apollo 15 is really pouring in the data to us. It's all good, as far as I can see at this quick look, and providing a lot of detailed information on the major mass cons. These are the mass concentrations located in the ring Maria, which were discovered on lunar, processing lunar orbiter data. But Mare Crisium, Imbrium, Serenitatis, and Smithii will be covered by this mission, and we'll have profiles in detail over these mass cons. The system for measuring them, of course, is the Doppler navigation system, measuring accelerations of the CSM as it passes over the ring Maria. Previously on lunar orbiter, we were at altitudes of something like 200 kilometers, and now Apollo 12 is going over these areas at 15 kilometers. So we're really down there on top of that thing. And previous readings were 180 milligals, whereas now they're between 400 and 500 milligals, which is much, much larger than anything we've ever seen on Earth as far as gravity measurements. One of the interesting things from Apollo 14, we have some low-altitude data over the Mare Nectaris, one of the mass cons, and it had a particular acceleration profile, which had kind of a flat top. An analysis of the profile over Serenitatis, which is the strongest one that we've analyzed, is much different. We were kind of anticipating it'd be similar. So there's some interesting facts here to unravel, and it's definitely going to give us some idea of shape, whether this thing is a flat slab or some kind of a lens-shaped feature, and give us, of course, some measurement on thickness. And you have to, of course, assume some kind of density differential here, but if one assumes a density differential of, say, 1 gram per cubic centimeter, then the thicknesses of these mass cons in the Serenitatis area would be between 7 and 10 kilometers thick, which is kind of an interesting little. And, of course, thickness for these mass cons would imply some kind of a crust to support them, and this again leads into the structure of the moon, and I'm sure Hal's going to have a lot of comments to make about this. This afternoon at 3 o'clock, they're jettisoning the sub-satellite, which will also give us some more gravity data, which would last for a year, and essentially map a zone of plus or minus 50 degrees of latitude across the front face of the moon. We're going to have some more detailed gravity information. Thank you.
Hey, Bill. Thank you. Bill Shogren and Bill Wallenhoff from the Manned Spacecraft Center was working with the laser altimeter data as it was coming in, and as you see the plot here in front of the stand of Rev 15, in which the laser altimeter worked perfectly, and we did get a complete profile of the moon. Bill Wallenhop, I can give you Mr. Shogren's name. I'll have to get together with you after the this briefing to give you Wallenhop. Shogren is S-J-O-G-R-E-N.
Wallenhop is W-O-L-L-E-N-H-A-U-P-T.
All right. Next speaker is Mr. Floyd Robison, who is a program scientist for the Orbital Science Program. He'll discuss quickly a number of the experiments, such as the sub-satellite that will be jettisoned later today. Floyd?
Thank you, George. According to my $2 watch, about a minute and a half ago, the crew of Apollo 15 performed a maneuver to change the orbit of the spacecraft from a nominal 60 by 60 circular orbit to a 55 by 75 miles elliptic orbit. The purpose of this orbit change is to provide an attitude and orbit for ejection of the subsatellite on the next rev, approximately an hour and 5 or 10 minutes from now, so that the subsatellite will remain in lunar orbit for its design life of at least a year. This will be a considerable extension of the scientific investigations that have gone so well so far on Apollo. We expect that the subsatellite will continue to provide good data from Apollo 15 for up to a year, possibly sometime longer. On the subsatellite, you've heard one of the experiments that will be carried, that Mr. Shogren just described, the S-band transponder, where he will be able to continue his gravity studies over a wide band of the central portion of the moon as the orbit of the spacecraft is a very high inclination, the 26 degrees that we're flying now, and as the moon rotates under it, he will sweep out the entire area between 26 degrees north and south on the front side of the moon in his gravity studies. The subsatellite also carries a magnetometer. The principal investigator for that experiment is Dr. Paul Coleman from UCLA. And it carries a charged particle experiment. The principal investigator is Dr. Kinsey Anderson, University of California at Berkeley. These two experiments, operating in conjunction, will provide detailed studies of the Earth's geomagnetic tail as the moon and the spacecraft in orbit about the moon sweep through the Earth's geomagnetic tail and the boundary layer. Will provide some new insights into the shape of the magnetic tail of the Earth and the way charged particles behave as they stream along the magnetic fields of force. And, of course, the magnetometer will be able to correlate its findings from this close-in orbit with those of the surface magnetometers in place by Apollo astronauts. Among the other tasks that have been conducted in the command module, you've probably heard of the ultraviolet photo task. Dr. Tobias Owen, State University of New York, as the principal investigator for this experiment. During lunar orbit and at three different points on the coast to the moon, while in lunar orbit and at three different points on the way back, the command module pilot has photographed the Earth with a Hasselblad camera and a series of ultraviolet filters. This is the first time that we've taken a look at the Earth in ultraviolet. As you may know, this is a technique that's used a great deal to study the atmospheres of Venus and Mars. And due to the variations in the UV emissions from these planets, we suspect it has something to do with the variation in the weather conditions. And this will give us an opportunity to study the ultraviolet emissions of our own planet when we know what the weather conditions are. As you know, right now, they're not too good. So this will give us an opportunity to extrapolate from the conditions on Earth to what we can predict about the condition of the planet's atmospheres. Also, this camera and its filters will be used to photograph the surface of the moon in the event that any UV emission from the lunar surface can be detected. Another experiment that's been conducted during the mission is an experiment that we took advantage of onboard equipment without having to build any hardware by using the VHF and S-band transmitters aboard. We've been able to conduct a bistatic radar experiment. The principal investigator for that experiment is Mr. Taylor Howard, Stanford University. This experiment is conducted by irradiating the lunar surface with the S-band and VHF radio signal and detecting on Earth the changes in that signal as it is bounced off the moon. The polarization and signal loss of that that received signal here on Earth is characteristic and gives a good deal of information about the surface roughness and the rubble layer and the dielectric constant of the near surface area. That's been conducted on two passes for the VHF and S-band. When we operate in the S-band, it requires that the spacecraft be in a continual pitch maneuver to keep the angles between the high-gain antenna and the lunar surface at the correct geometry to get the signal on Earth. And then in an additional VHF-only mode throughout an entire sleep cycle. So Mr. Howard is getting a great deal of VHF data over some new areas that we haven't flown over before. The command module pilot and his crew, I think, will probably give him some help on some of these on the way back, has conducted experiments in lunar orbit that we call dim light photography tasks. As you, I'm sure, know, when you're on the backside of the moon, where you cannot see the Earth and where you're still in the shade of the moon from the sun, you're in the darkest region that man can reach. You're in a double umbra of the moon where you're not receiving any reflected light from the Earth nor any direct sunlight. This gives a unique opportunity to take pictures of very dim astronomical phenomena. One of these experiments is Mr. Larry Dunkelman's experiment to study the Gegenschein phenomena. And, of course, at the same time as we're in orbit around the moon, we can use the moon as an occulting disk to make some careful studies of the solar corona as the sunrise and sunset terminator approach. Also in the dim light photography mode, taking use of the dark, the high-speed film that's available, the crew will photograph the moon on their way back when the moon is eclipsed by the Earth. I believe that's tomorrow. And then, of course, the one unique condition that's that we have available in this Apollo program is the crew's observations and their ability to look and find interesting targets. We've had serious and long training sessions, Mr. Farouk Elbaz, Mr. Mazursky, among the geologists who have discussed these matters with the crew, pointing out areas of important geologic interest and training Al Warden in what to look for in these particular targets, to photograph them, and what features that they're excited about and what they'd like to hear descriptions of. He's done an excellent job, as most of you have heard, over the net describing features of geologic interest. Tsiolkovsky is one that he's given repeated description of on the backside, and it's an exciting feature. That's all of the other non-SIM experiments we have.
Thank you, Floyd. To wrap this up now, Mr. Harold Mazursky from the USGS will give us a five-minute summary here to see how this all falls together. Hal?
May I have the first slide? This has been a most exciting mission because we've reached the point of being able to work on the moon as one does in trying to understand a part of the Earth that you study first by photographs and then by visiting the site and collecting rocks and getting them analyzed and looking at the area with a variety of geochemical and geophysical tools. Now, this great mass of information is now starting to come together. This slide that you see on the wall is shows the shape of the moon as projected a couple of years ago from the very fragmentary information that we had. On the front side, we had indications that the lunar surface was some 2 kilometers low from the impacts of Ranger and the landings of Surveyor. And we had an indication that the far side was quite high from the scattered landmark sightings taken by the astronauts. During this mission, the laser altimeter worked, and before it turned up its toes and passed away, it did a magnificent job, and you can examine in detail the profile from revs 15 and 16 that's on the front of the podium. And what it shows is that the moon is, in fact, 2 kilometers low at the west side of the front side. And then it descends steadily to the eastward, and is about 5 kilometers low at the floor of Mare Smithi over in the east limb. Then it rises rapidly 9.5 kilometers to the far side highlands, which extend essentially uninterrupted around the complete far side. Now, the interesting thing is that the moon's radius is supposed to be 1738 kilometers, and that was established by very careful astronomic observations of the limb of the moon. And it turns out, examining this beautiful profile that the laser altimeter has constructed, that the only two places on the moon that are that elevation really are the two limbs where we've always observed it. Everything else is either lower or higher. Also, we can trust landmark sightings done by astronauts, because John Young looked at Mare Smithi, and he found that the floor was 5 kilometers below nominal lunar radius. Nobody believed him. He was right on the money. And there have been three observations of elevations on the far side that are more than 4 kilometers above the mean lunar radius, and those turn out to be exactly right. And as a matter of fact, the front side then varies from 2 to 5 kilometers low, and the far side from 2 to 5 kilometers high. I watched with great admiration as Shogren and Wallenhop managed to extract from their computer this information and plotted it up in near real time. The next slide shows the map that Shogren and Muller published from analysis of lunar orbiter data showing the presence of the mascons and the other variations on the front side. And these are beautifully confirmed by this tracking, and it shows the very close relationship between the circular basins and the large mascons. It is particularly nice in that it skirts the southern flank of the Imbrium Basin and shows the mascon is concentrated in the central part of the basin. And I think this confirms the hypothesis that the mascons are due to the ISIS, or the rebound after impact of the central peaks of the large basins. The other thing that shows beautifully in the tracking is the flatness of the Oceanus Procol Arm, the only ocean basin on the moon. It's amazingly flat. It's 2 kilometers low. The track that we have crosses the Marius Hills and shows that they rise up and look very much like the medial ridge of the terrestrial ocean basins. I think we have strong confirmation from the lack of a mascon there that it is something quite different from the circular basins. The final slide shows a geologic interpretation of the near side, and the tracks are the tracks of the spacecraft at the beginning and end. And that top track is one that has been plotted, or the results of the X-ray spectrometer. And the data came in, and I saw Jack Kromka each night when I went on duty, and he was busily working away with his daughter helping him plot his data. And then a great storm arose at Goddard, and all their 3 computers went down. And he threw all of his resources into the fray and managed to extract some information locally and plotted the stuff up by hand. And there's a beautiful correlation across each of these basins showing that the alumina is high in all the high areas and low in the Mare basins, which reflects the relative abundance of plagioclase in the 2 areas. And even more amazing, each little topographic feature is accurately reflected in the chemical composition. And at first we accused him of having an instrument that accurately was reading the topography, and he denied that this is the case. And then the conclusion must be that each topographic feature reflects the geochemistry of that feature. That is, each low and high area is there because of a geologic process that results in geochemical segregation. And the best example is the variation in the Mare materials. We don't see any regional variation because the data has not been thoroughly worked. But in each case, the oldest Mare basin has the highest alumina content. And this leads us to think that the impacts that take place in the highlands scatter highland material across the Mare basins and contaminate it. And as one goes across them and crosses the successively younger Mare basins, then they have less and less aluminum. And the lowest point he has of all is in the dark ring around the Serenitatis Basin, which we think is one of the youngest volcanic areas on the moon, and that has the lowest alumina content. So it was most exciting to find that all of these features seem to tie so nicely between the geologic age as determined by wholly independent means and finally some good geochemical work. Have the lights, please. The last thing is the very nice relationship between various kinds of experiments, both on the surface and in orbit. The metric camera sets up a very strong control network. It's tied to the surface of the moon by the laser altimeter. It flew over the Apollo 15 site, and the crew set up a laser retroreflector at that site. That will be nicely tied to Earth by measurements from telescopes. Since it's a very large array, many small telescopes all around the world will be able to sight in on this retroreflector. So we'll be able to tie together the control systems of the Earth and the moon. Then, since there are many telescopes that can observe it, one can look at the variations on the Earth's surface. It's commonly believed now that the continents are drifting, and they think in about 6 years, They can actually measure directly the drift of the continents by looking at the laser retroreflector. This seems to me that it ties the whole thing together almost like an ancient Persian tapestry with convolutions all nicely looping together. It seems to me that we've gotten so much information of such a variety that if we just got the return samples from Sharp Crater on the Apennine Front and this one Rev 15, that the mission would have been very much worth flying.
Thank you, Hal.
I've just been informed that there was a nominal burn on the shaping burn and that the new orbit is 76.0 nautical miles by 54.3, which I assume is satisfactory for the launch of the sub-satellite. Since the sub-satellite is scheduled to be launched just an hour from now, and since I'm sure you and these gentlemen want to listen to the results of that in real time, we will go for about a half an hour here, if that long. Suggest that you hold your questions to one or two so that we can get to as many people as possible. The one here, the man in the yellow shirt in the third row.
I guess this would be for Bill Shogren. In flying the geochemistry experiments over the mass cons, have you been able to get any information on what the substance of the mass cons might be?
I think
the answer to that question would be quite simply no.
Except insofar as we see Mare material in those Mare places. The gamma ray experiment, which is the deepest penetrating, that's why I spoke up, penetrates that far into the lunar surface fundamentally. If this material that's causing the mass cons is deeper than that, we don't expect to see anything specifically associated with the mass con as such.
Don Kirkman here, and then over to Bill Hines.
Yes, Dr. Doyle, do you have any idea how many pictures total you got from the Simbay cameras?
We expended all of the pan camera film, which is 1,700 exposures, and we will expend all of the mapping camera film, which is 3,600 exposures. Not all of those mapping camera films will, of course, be of the surface. Some of them were made on the backside where the stellar camera supported the altimetry. Others of them will be made during trans-Earth coast.
Bill Hines.
Thank you, Bill. First of all, I'd just like to see if I can say that each of the pictures about 15 times 10 to the 9th bits of units had something about 15 trillion. This, even 15 times 10 to the 9th or 15 billion. 10 to the 9th is billion. Okay. Well,
you said
been obtained by all flights manned or unmanned before, and this would include all the lunar orbiter mapping, which was almost a complete surface of the moon?
The lunar orbiter did indeed cover almost the complete surface of
the moon. However, the resolution of that photography was very, very low as compared to what we have obtained on these passes. Also, the lunar orbiter photography did not have what we call metric characteristics. It is impossible to measure that photography and compute the locations of points on the surface of the moon with any appreciable accuracy, anything that would increase our knowledge of the dimensions of the moon. However, with the mapping camera photography obtained from this mission, we will be able to establish the locations of any points somewhere between 15 and 30 meters.
Victor McElhenney in the front row.
Mr. Doyle, from what you've just said, are we to, about the mapping camera being turned back on the moon in recession, one will get some hundreds of frames of the moon in recession from the map camera?
No, we will not be able to maintain that attitude long enough to get hundreds of frames, but we don't need hundreds of frames because they are essentially repetitive. I don't really know exactly how many we do plan to take, but only a handful.
Ms. Driscoll?
Dr. Gornstein, have you or have you not seen radon?
At this point, we have no evidence for radon.
Are we flying over Alphonsus? And if not, does that mean you're thinking about Littrow for 17?
Pardon me, you repeat that question?
No. Hal, you want to answer that one?
Yeah. Get the last half. No, we're not flying over Alphonsus.
Then are you thinking about Littrow for 17?
No, Littrow washed out some time ago.
John Wilhelm in the front row.
Minicons.
We haven't examined the data in that detail that we can say that there are minicons. I don't know what you're talking about, minicons, something on the order of 20 or 30 milligals versus the 400 milligals.
No, negative.
Oh. Well, I mean negative gravity anomalies rather than positive gravity anomalies. Yeah, on Apollo 12 and 14, we noticed that the large craters, Ptolemaeus, Hipparchus, Theophilus, are all negative gravity anomalies, these large craters. So there is a transition point between positive gravity in these large circular basins, whether that comes with a crater the size of Grimaldi or Iridum. We can't put our fingers directly on that yet.
And found any on this mission?
A large negative craters. We haven't gone over anything like that.
Walter Sullivan.
A quick question for Dr. Hoffman. You said CO2, as I understand it, not CO.
CO2 is correct.
And
carbon dioxide.
Can you give us a location more than just the backside?
I don't have it pinpoint exactly, but it was across the Sunset Terminator and a ways into the backside, not nearly to the middle of the backside, but somewhat across the Terminator.
You said 7 kilometers. Was that the depth of the mass cone? I didn't quite get that.
Yes, if you assume a density differential of 1, which is relatively a high density differential, I think most geologists, geophysicists would think of about 0.3 as a density differential. But if you assume the density differential of about of 1, then you'd have something on the order of 7 kilometers, 10 kilometers thick.
You have no anomaly on Earth up around whatever it was. Was it 400 milligals or something like that? I think you said the anomaly on Earth to compare with these.
I don't believe there are any readings that are that high. I think they're around 200 to 300, and here we're reading 400 to 500 milligals as far as the gravity anomaly. Is that correct, Hal?
Are there other questions? If not, thank you, gentlemen.